books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week, in a more somber episode of Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, I talked to Dr. Gavin Francis about his book, The Unfragile Mind, Making Sense of Mental Health. I talked to journalist Stephen McGinty about his book, One Morning in March, Dunblane and the Shooting That Changed Britain. And first up today, I'll talk to Darren McGarvey, aka rapper Loki, about his book, Trauma, Industrial Complex. Darren McGarvey is a Glasgow-based writer, performer, community activist and journalist. Under his alter ego Loki, he is one of Scotland's most high-profile rap artists. Between 2004 and 2006, he wrote and presented 8 programmes for BBC Radio Scotland, which attempted to examine the root causes of antisocial behaviour and social deprivation. In 2018, his book Poverty Safari, Understanding the Anger of Britain's Underclass, was published, and it became a Sunday Times Top 10 bestseller. It won the Orwell Prize, and the Scottish Book Trust called it the most rebellious read of the 21st century. He followed that up with the book The Social Distance Between Us, How Remote Politics Wrecked Britain. But he was at Boswell Book Festival to talk about his third book, Trauma, Industrial Complex, How Oversharing Became a Product in the Digital World. All three books are read by the author, Darren McGarvey.
There's a contradiction at the heart of this book, which I must acknowledge up front. In writing about the culture of public storytelling around trauma and the dangers of oversharing, I inevitably divulge parts of my own personal story. In warning against the rush to public declaration, I unearth revelations of my own. This paradox has followed me throughout the writing process. If I argue that we need to think more critically about when, how, and why we tell our stories, what does it mean for me to set mine down on these pages? Having given it deep consideration, as well as seeking advice and guidance, I've reached the conclusion that the only way to make these arguments convincingly is to subject myself to the same standards and scrutiny I'd happily apply to anyone else who shares their experiences in a public way. This book isn't just analysis of the ongoing cultural conversation around trauma or the rise of lived experience advocacy. It attempts to embody those principles in practice. I become the case study, drawing the reader into the very narratives I also attempt to deconstruct. But unlike many personal stories of trauma told by survivors themselves, I don't just have experience of sharing my adversity in a public way. I have experience of becoming a public figure who's repeatedly identified and framed by it.
I'm here to talk about my third book, Trauma Industrial Complex. It's a book about the dangers of oversharing your personal life and your work or at media level. And a kind of cultural critique of the rise of people talking about trauma in a very public way.
You think there is a danger in sharing that kind of trauma?
Oh, certainly. I mean, my book's definitely written from the perspective where I understand the power of lived experience stories that help other people identify with certain experiences and also raise wider awareness to drive reform and political change. So it's an absolutely essential part of any conversation at cultural level with respect to, you know, different adversities people go through. But I think there is wild variability in terms of how what I call in the book lived experience storytellers might be treated before, during and after they're disclosing their experiences. And the book draws from my lived experience of becoming quite prominent in 2017, 2018, after the publication of my first book. Poverty Safari, which none of us thought would become a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're Channel 4 News, you're doing Start of the Week, and then you feel like you've let too much toothpaste out of the tube with some of the trauma that you've talked about, and I've been trying to get the toothpaste back in the tube ever since.
This book allows me to apply everything I've learned from being a public face of issues like poverty, addiction and trauma, issues of which I have first-hand experience. But instead of my story being extracted by a broadcaster or charity with their own agenda, well-meaning or otherwise, here I take complete control of my narrative. In doing so, I hope to highlight that while all personal experiences matter, and that anyone who shares them earnestly in the public square is undeniably brave, there is, or should be, a structured process to publicly airing adversity where duty of care is paramount to every other concern, a process I fear we have lost sight of in the race to be seen to platform the voiceless. This is not an argument for silence, of course. It's not a rejection of storytelling, nor a criticism of those who have found purpose or healing in sharing their pain. I have done it myself. I know the relief that comes with feeling heard and validated, as well as the joy of learning how stories of our difficulties have inspired others to keep moving or stick around. But I also know the costs of becoming publicly identified with those difficulties. I have learned, sometimes painfully, that sharing doesn't always bring clarity, that broadcasting trauma doesn't necessarily lead to healing, and that the impact of telling one's story is not always within the control of the storyteller.
Was that a hard book to write?
Process-wise, this was the easiest book to write. By virtue of having two completely different experiences to draw from with previous books, also not having lockdown to contend with and tumultuous political events, which always end up making your thesis redundant because this book was a very specific thing and not a general State of the Union politics book. I think it was insulated from a lot of what was going on at the level of politics, and for that reason it was much easier to get into a rhythm in terms of laying out the arguments and the structure.
I wrote this book because I have lived through the cycle of disclosure and its aftermath. I've seen trauma storytelling become a commodity, a currency in advocacy, media and activism. I've seen personal pain shaped, edited and packaged for consumption, often serving others more than the storyteller themselves. I've seen how public vulnerability can trap people in fixed identities, making it harder to grow beyond the story they've told. I don't claim to have the final word on this subject, but I do believe the conversation is necessary and that I am suitably placed to initiate it. My position in this conversation around trauma is unusual. I have a public platform. My work is recognised in fields where discussion and debate around trauma dominate. But unlike most people who tell their stories, or indeed those organisations and enterprises that facilitate them, I don't draw funding or a salary from an organisation or institution. I don't have a boss and therefore enjoy the rare privilege and occasional burden of speaking freely while still making a living.
Have you narrated the audio version of all your books?
I have, yes, and that is a part of the process that I quite enjoy. I come from an artist background, so I'm a bit more used to being in a vocal booth than most authors. So I quite enjoy that aspect of it. And I think it's always heightened when you have a good producer or director who's sort of pulling you up when you're getting a bit lazy or monotonous, or you're not really inhabiting the text. And readers really respond to the author's own voice. My readers, certainly, I can speak to that. I mean, just from the sales of audiobooks, I can see that that's a big, big draw for a lot of my audience.
Is it important that the book's now accessible for someone for whatever reason doesn't have a relationship with print?
Absolutely. And I think, as well as, you know, obvious candidates who would prefer audiobook if print's not something that they can engage with for accessibility reasons, I think general population, you see a big variability in terms of people's endurance for reading. Some people, they never learned to work that muscle in their childhood, and they just seem to retain information better when it's visual and audio. Now, obviously, you'll have a lot of purists out there who say, well, that's not the right way to read a book. I mean, I would rather that they went with the audio book than go with no book at all. Mm-hmm. And I, myself, I'm someone who very much seems to absorb information when it's more like a discussion rather than sometimes the labour of reading. I know at Boswell a lot of people will be like, well, you talk about the labour of reading. I live to read, you know, but we're not all built like that.
I believe this means I have a responsibility to say what so many have been discussing privately for years. If we truly care about the well-being of those living with trauma, we must reconsider the wisdom of modelling a process that encourages impulsive, unstructured public exhibitionism. Disclosing our truths is an essential part of healing, but doing so publicly is not. This book is an invitation to think more critically about the culture of storytelling around trauma, to question how stories are elicited and consumed, and to reflect on what we owe ourselves and each other in the telling. So yes, there is a contradiction here, but one I accept now as unavoidable. Because to interrogate the nature of personal storytelling, one must tell a personal story. And this is mine.
Trauma Industrial Complex: How Oversharing Became a Product in a Digital World, and The Social Distance Between Us, How Remote Politics Wrecked Britain, both written and read by Darren McGarvey, are both available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Poverty Safari is available commercially.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And Darren will be back at the end of the show with Books of My Life. Still to come, we'll talk to journalist Stephen McGinty and we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. But first,
Gavin Francis is a doctor and writer from Edinburgh. He alternates between writing travel books and writing about medicine. In his latest travel book, The Bridge Between Worlds, he explored bridges old and new, man-made or natural, musing on the view from the bridge through history, geopolitics, psychology and literature. But he was at the Boswell Book Festival to talk about The Unfragile Mind. Between a quarter and a fifth of young people in the UK now suffer a mental disorder. One in four adults are prescribed psychiatric medication. These numbers represent a huge and recent expansion in mental health labelling, but reveal nothing of the experience of those seeking help. This book is about the contours and landscapes of mental health. The audio version of The Unfragile Mind is read by the author, Dr. Gavin Francis.
There are plenty of ways to injure your head as a kid. You can fall from a rope swing onto packed earth. You can be bouncing on a bed, jostled by a companion and smack your temple on an unyielding piece of furniture. You can be learning how to do wheelies on your bike and fall over backwards onto concrete. You can misjudge the robustness of a branch and fall 20 feet from a tree. As a child, I tried all of these ways of braining myself and more, and each time had been rewarded with a trip to the local hospital. By my teens, I'd already seen inside my own skull a few times, through the magic of X-rays. Hospital was a place of clean white lines and sterilised blue curtains, its air thick with the smell of antiseptic floor cleaner. To be there was to feel cared for by confident, competent people who, despite their brisk efficiency, seemed possessed of great kindness. And on my brief, occasional overnight stays, I came to anticipate that same atmosphere of care. I liked the rhythm of the nurses coming and going between night shift, morning, and back shift, the daily offices of the cleaners as they made their life-saving circuit of the wards, the porters bustling and whistling, cracking jokes, the occasional unpredictable arrival of the doctors themselves.
My name's Gavin Francis, I'm a GP and a writer, and the book that I've written over the last 3 years. It's called The Unfragile Mind, Making Sense of Mental Health. And it's about the fact that, you know, as a GP, about a third of my workload concerns discussing mental health nowadays. And so it's a call for more humility and curiosity and kindness in the way that we talk about and think about mental health.
Is there a overdiagnosis epidemic?
When you interpret the statistics about diagnosis, it's very difficult actually to compare like with like. So there's no doubt that we've got a lot more mental health illness being diagnosed now than, say, 30 years ago when I started in medicine. But actually the way we count it is completely different now. We have lowered the threshold for what counts as a mental illness, which increases it. We've also completely changed the way as a society we access information, removed all the gatekeepers to finding out about specialist, what was once considered specialist mental health. And at the same time, we've, through mental health awareness campaigns, we've massively destigmatized mental illness, which is a good thing. So yes, we're seeing a lot more mental health diagnosis nowadays, but it's not completely straightforward to interpret that as more people are just over-interpreting their symptoms, because we have changed the way we count it.
The scars on my scalp are testimony of those injuries, but so were the X-ray films the staff ordered, which in those days were printed on stiff acetate sheets, black as welding masks. Years later, I returned to the same hospital as a qualified doctor, and searching the basement for notes on a patient who shared my surname, I came across my own file of X-rays, a buff cardboard wallet crammed with ghostly images of my childhood skull. Even to a young child, the skull is familiar from countless Halloween parodies, a universal symbol of mortality and the macabre. But when I held up images of my own skull to the buzzing strip lights, there was only wonder. At the neat tangle of bone around the ears, the petrous bone, hard as a rock, the same root as petrified. The caverns of the sinuses above, behind and below the eyes that change the resonance of the voice. The crisp rigidity of the jaw, the strongest bone of the body, with its row of socketed teeth. The little scoop of bone at the centre, round as a ladle that saddles the pituitary gland, the body's hormonal headquarters. But what struck me most on seeing again my own childhood skull was the round think bubble of the cranial vault, seemingly so empty because brain tissue doesn't show up on X-rays. In adults, the skull becomes marbled with the imprint of veins. Blood pumps over the brain so vigorously that its blood vessels thin the overlying bone. In a certain light, the skull can be seen as the repository of all that makes us human, an ever-locked safe of the magical stuff of life.
So it should be more a person-centred approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So the call of this book is that we need to, or we as a society would benefit from, thinking about mental health in a more fluid, dynamic, flexible, supportive way, rather than thinking about it as a series of categories that you either fall into or don't. We should think about it as dimensions of being or dimensions of living. And every mental illness has at its core something which in a different dose or a different context could contribute to human well-being rather than detract from it. So I would like us to move away from the overly medicalizing approach to thinking about distress and different kinds of mental experience and think about it in a more inclusive and dynamic and ultimately hopeful way.
In my teens, I began to think of the brain in another way, as the origin and steersman of my mood. For years, I was prone to episodes of plunging mood, a recurrent sinking feeling as if submerged in cold liquid or perhaps encased by some invisible barrier that insulated me from all that felt good in the world, all that rendered life worth living. Sometimes the cloaking heaviness was still and cold, weighing on my sense of self like a leaden coat. At other times, it was blurred, agitated and tremulous, and I'd feel stricken with fear over things undone, things that may never be done, that may never happen, that I might never learn how to do.
I believe you read the audio version of this book. How was that?
Yes, yeah, so that is the second or third one of my books that I've read. I find the whole business of reading audiobooks quite stressful, quite difficult. It took me 3 days in a recording studio to get through the 80,000 words. Ultimately, though, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed having that level of control over it. And I was told by the audiobook producers that I did a good job. So at the beginning I said, oh, you don't want to get me to do it. You want to go and get a professional actor to do it. And they said, oh, no, you're good at it. You're good at it. Honestly, you might enjoy it. And I did feel a sense of satisfaction when I got to the end. Yeah.
Did you resist the urge to edit it as you were reading it?
I did very much. Yeah, I did very much. I did notice a couple of grammatical punctuation errors as I was reading it slowly out. And so I got the audiobook producer to make a note of those and we've got them fixed.
Now, as I've said, you've treated people with sight loss, but now it's in audio. It's available to people for whatever reason, dyslexia, sight loss, don't have a relationship with the printed word. Is that important?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, some people, I really meet a lot of patients for all sorts of reasons who don't appreciate the more traditional approach to reading books. So a lot of people whose sight and who don't have dyslexia even, they prefer to listen to books rather than read them. So I think it's just a different way of thinking about the concepts that I want to introduce in this book. And I'm not precious about books having to be perceived as books. No.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer writing about medicine or writing about travel?
I like to alternate, to be honest. I've written 5 medical books, 4 travel books, 1 unorthodox biography, and I quite like shifting. So each project I will shift. It's kind of, I find that refreshing. It sort of cleanses the palate in a way. It's a different way of thinking about description, about literature, about writing.
So is your next book travel and where are you going?
Yeah, well, this book came out only 2 months ago, so I'm still in that fallow period where a new project hasn't kind of erupted into my consciousness. But what happens is some idea will come and then it'll take over and it becomes impossible to resist, and then the book writes itself. So that'll happen. I'm quite confident it will. It'll come sooner or later.
The mind is pliable and suggestible, weaving its own reality from moment to moment. And it seems to me now that the lack of a formal diagnosis meant that I never felt locked into an expectation of feeling a certain way, or worried that my brain was in some way different from the brains of others, more sensitive or vulnerable to such lows. Denying it a label perhaps made it easier for me, when the time came, to shrug off that leaden coat. If the opposite pole of depression is mania, the opposite of anxiety might be inertia, a problem which occasionally finds its way into my office, manifesting as an inability to contemplate change. There are extreme versions of anxiety in which action becomes impossible. The idea of change itself becomes too frightening, but to be truly inert is to have no desire for change and doesn't occasion the kind of abrasive, problematic behaviour that brings people into conflict with others the way psychosis or addiction can do. But the mind isn't built on simple binaries, and there is another opposite to anxiety. A deep sense of equanimity, an abiding sense of good and rightness in the world, the conviction that nothing can or will go wrong.
The Unfragile Mind, Making Sense of Mental Health, written and read by Dr. Gavin Francis, is available commercially. One of Gavin's travel books is available in the RNIB library. Empire Antarctica, Ice, Silence and Emperor Penguins. The story of how Gavin spent 14 months living alongside Emperor Penguins as the base camp doctor at Halley in Antarctica. It's read by Tom Carter and runs for 9 hours, 51 minutes.
Thanks again to Gavin Francis. Now, along with Gavin's book, let's find some other biographies in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are 2 new gems. Kids, Wait Till You Hear This by Liza Minnelli was donated by Penguin Random House.
Picture this. I'm 19 years old, sitting inside the Astor Hotel Ballroom in New York City for Broadway's biggest night. The 1965 Tony Awards are being announced, and I can't believe what's just happened. Bert Lahr, Mama's Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, has called my name. I've just won the Tony for Best Actress in a musical. I'm Dorothy's daughter, the youngest person ever to win this honor. It's crazy what runs through your mind at a moment like this. You can't know how meaningful it is to me, because I've done this on my own. I'll always be the daughter of Judy Garland and Vincent Minnelli, and I'm damn proud of that. Mama is one of the world's most celebrated, beloved, and iconic performers. Papa is a trailblazing director who redefined cinema. Although I privately called him Daddy, he'll be Papa in this book. He may have worked behind the camera, but he's had no less of an impact on me. As young people say, I was the original Nepo baby. Ha ha! Now at last I have my own identity.
In this deeply candid memoir, Liza pulls back the curtain on her extraordinary life, from her meteoric rise to Broadway and Hollywood stardom, to the whirlwind of high-profile marriages and scandalous affairs, as well as the private heartbreaks of multiple miscarriages and lifelong struggle with substance use disorder. She relives the liberated nights at Studio 54, the activism and friendships that shaped her, and the fearless way she defied conventions, embracing sexual fluidity long before it was part of the public conversation. But above all, as she turns 80 years old, Liza is ready to reclaim her truth, dispelling the tabloid myths and setting the record straight with stories she's never shared before. Raw, strong, sexy, hilarious, and unapologetically honest, this is a defiant celebration of self-belief, survival, and stardust, proving once and for all why Liza remains one of the most captivating performers the world has ever known.
The applause swells, and I hurry to the stage, my mind racing. I'm hearing the words to A Quiet Thing in my head, the beautiful number I sing every night as the lead in Flora, the Red Menace. To this day, it's my favorite song in the world. When it all comes true, just the way you planned, it's funny how the bells don't ring. It's a quiet thing. Happiness comes in on tiptoe. Well, what do you know? It's a quiet thing, a very quiet thing. In my brief remarks, I thank the people who made this possible for me. Composer John Kander, lyricist Fred Ebb, producer Hal Prince, director George Abbott, and Bob Dishy, my leading man. I'm also sending a message to people who said I'd never sing as well as Mama. Well, who the hell can? On this amazing night, my future is bright. And even though I'm afraid it could all be taken away from me in an instant, I truly want to believe it is the beginning of a career which will last for my entire life.
Kids, wait till you hear this, by Liza Minnelli, is read by the author and runs for 17 hours and 56 minutes.
Winner, My Racing Life by Tony McCoy, was given to us by Orion.
Two jumps from home, the realisation hit me. I'd been holding box office on the inside of a tightly bunched field, and he was going well. After clearing the third last, I eased across to the outside, tucking in behind Richard Johnson, whom I could see was building to a strong finish on Brother Ted, and I wanted to go with him. Box office was strongly in contention coming round the final bend for home, and I was sensing a winner. As we approached the second last, however, both Brother Ted and Grand Maestro began to pull away from the pack, and jumping in third place and coming up the hill towards the finish, it became clear that box office didn't have an answer on the day. It was only then, when I had to reluctantly admit to myself the race was lost, that something other than the thunder of hooves and the rhythm of my own breathing muscled in on my thought process. "This is it," said a voice in my head. "This really is the end."
Tony A.P. McCoy has collected a record 20 consecutive jump jockey titles to date, and since 1992 has ridden over 4,300 winners. This powerfully honest memoir looks at life at the very top in national hunt racing and beyond, discussing fatherhood, writing novels, and his decision to retire while he's still a long way ahead. It's a definitive autobiography that is themed around AP's 10 most important races: his first ride, first race, first fall, first win, greatest disappointment, and greatest triumph. These are the memoirs of a true champion, an icon of sport, whose astonishing achievements over the past 20 years are unlikely to be surpassed. It is a great story of courage and triumphs, setbacks and pain, the private and public life of a riding phenomenon.
I was now a matter of seconds away from the moment all the numbers stopped forever. My career total of national hunt winners would remain at 4,348 after this, my 17,546th ride. I'd never add to my 20 champion jockey titles. I'd never win another Grand National or Cheltenham Gold Cup. All the stats, the numbers that had governed my life for the last two decades, they were just a few hundred yards from being stilled forever. My whole career, my whole adult life even, had been built on making those numbers click upwards as fast as I could. But in a little over a couple of furlongs, they would never move again. I cleared the final fence of my racing career, saw the two leaders pull further away, and became aware of a couple of horses in the corner of my vision. There was no way they were getting past. Box office might not have had enough left in the tank to win that day, but I was sure as hell that I'd ride the final furlongs of my career as hard as any I'd ever ridden before. I'd clocked up somewhere in the region of 40,000 miles of racing during my career, equivalent to going twice around the world. And now I gritted my teeth, reached for my stick, and knuckled down for the last two furlongs of my racing life.
Winner, by Tony McCoy, is read by Stephen Armstrong and runs for 10 hours and 9 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Still to come, the books of my life from Darren McGarvey. But now, let's hear from Scottish journalist Stephen McGinty. Please note, the following interview contains subject matter that some listeners may find upsetting.
Stephen McGinty is one of Scotland's leading journalists and the author of 5 non-fiction books, including Fire in the Night, The Piper Alpha Disaster, which was critically acclaimed and highly praised for its sensitive yet compelling handling of a national tragedy. As a documentary producer, he made Dunblane, Our Story, the BAFTA-winning documentary about the shooting, released in 2016 for the 20th anniversary. That led to the book One Morning in March, Dunblane and the Shooting That Changed Britain. On the 13th of March 1996, at Dunblane Primary School, 16 pupils and one teacher were murdered, and many more injured, in the deadliest mass shooting in British history. The crime didn't just shock the nation, it changed it, but only after an extraordinary political battle by a group of grieving parents determined that the atrocity would never be repeated. The audio version of One Morning in March is read by Angus King.
It was better last year, said one little boy of the summer camp on the island in the loch. No one got hit. This year, there was a lot of hitting. You got hit for not doing your exercise properly. If you fainted or said it was too sore or weren't standing up straight enough. You weren't punched, you were only slapped. He held your neck with one hand and slapped you in the face with the other hand. or sometimes he would beat you on the bottom or on your bare legs with a wooden spoon. If you wanted to go home and started crying, you might get a couple of slaps. One boy got 2 slaps in the face and he wasn't doing anything, just toasting bread over the campfire. Another boy got a slap for putting wood on the fire when they were all told not to. But it was only a few twigs, and other boys were doing it and they didn't get slapped. You could get a slap for scratching your face at the wrong time, or even for yawning. The most slaps any boy got was the boy who said he wanted to go home. And when told he couldn't go home, the boy said he would tell his dad. He got taken into the tent, and everyone outside could hear the slaps, and one boy's brother counted up to 16 or 17. The boy came out crying and ran off to his tent, and everyone could see that his back and face was all red.
One morning in March is about the Dunblane shooting, which is arguably the worst crime in Britain of the 20th century, when a gunman went into a primary school in Dunblane and killed 16 primary one pupils, their teacher, injured 15 other children, some of them horrifically. People remember the event, or may remember the event, but what the book does is explain how it came about, how the gunman responsible was allowed to effectively build together an arsenal, but it does something more importantly than that. It tells the untold story of how the parents, after the event, managed to have the strength to campaign to ban handguns in Britain, to make Britain the safe, effectively a much safer nation. And that's a part of the story that people do not know. And I think it's very important because people have largely forgotten that Britain, at the time, had gun laws similar to America. Mm.
The waters of Loch Lomond are cold and grey, even in high summer. The Vikings once sailed down the length of the loch, having carried their longships overland from Loch Long and pillaged the small island communities, stealing livestock and murdering residents. Dotted throughout the vast expanse of water are dozens of little islands, including one populated by Australian wallabies, the fecund offspring of a single imported pair. On the western shore is Luss, the principal location for the popular television soap opera Take the High Road, whose honey-coloured stone cottages make it one of Scotland's prettiest villages. On the afternoon of the 20th of July 1988, 2 officers from Central Scotland Police, the nation's smallest police force, were ferried on the mail boat across from the boatyard at Balmaha on the eastern shore to the uninhabited island of Inchmoan. Balmaha is a pretty little village, with a cluster of wooden holiday chalets and a general store. Wedged in the centre of a horseshoe bay, the village has acted for over a century as a natural marina for amateur sailors to anchor their yachts, cabin cruisers, skiffs or rowing boats. Technically, this part of the loch and islands fell under the jurisdiction of Strathclyde Police, the country's largest police force. But Strathclyde had struggled to source a boat, and so asked the officers from Central to go on their behalf. This made sense. Central Scotland Police had received the bulk of the complaints, beginning in the evening of Sunday the 17th of July.
Do you find, after the event, there was a severe lack of accountability?
I think after the event, there was a massive investigation into what had happened, but only one person resigned, which was the Deputy Chief Constable, or the person who had been Deputy Chief Constable. But these events are always very, very complicated in terms of, it's like past the parcel, effectively. People are responsible for very, very small parts of the situation. Mm. But, you know, the individual responsible for it killed himself, so there was no opportunity for justice in that respect. There was only the consequence of it. But I think what is important is that, what people will forget is that the reason we have a gun ban is not because of the Conservative government at the time. People will forget that, and we only know this now because the archives have been released. And what happened was the Dunblane shooting took place on Wednesday, the 13th of March. On Thursday, the 14th of March, the Conservative government of John Major met in Cabinet and discussed the issue. And the collective view at the time was quotes, and this is a direct quote from the minutes now released into the National Archives, the incident did not suggest need for legislative change. So the view was this could happen and people should still be permitted to allow to own 357 Magnums, 44 Magnums, 9mm Browning automatics. And it was the parents and the Snowdrop campaign who ensured that that was not the case, that a ban would eventually come in.
The parents of several unhappy campers had called both the Central and Strathclyde police forces with numerous complaints that boys in the party had been physically assaulted and slapped. Gunn and Duncan, dressed in dark blue uniforms and regulation anoraks, clambered out of their boat and made their way through a thicket of trees to a clearing where a cluster of tents were arranged. There were no adults in sight. Instead, several young boys, aged around 8 or 9, were playing, unsupervised, 30 yards from the shoreline, the majority dressed only in swimming trunks, despite the chill weather, with only a few benefiting from the additional layer of a t-shirt. The officers could see that each child's bare legs were a tapestry of scratches. The boys explained that Mr. Hamilton did not permit trousers while at camp.
Was it a hard book to write?
It was an exceptionally hard book to write. I've been toying with the idea, or thinking about the idea on and off for almost 30 years. I first thought about it maybe 8 months after the event, and then seriously thought about it for the 20th anniversary when I made a documentary, or produced a documentary with Stephen Bennett, the director, for the BBC called Dumbleen Our Story. And I couldn't figure out a way to do it. I couldn't figure out a way how to move beyond what you had written about what the horrors of what took place in the gym hall. How do you move beyond that? And it was only after Pam Ross, who had lost her daughter and had helped, you know, supported us when we made the documentary for the 20th anniversary, invited me to an event to mark the 25th anniversary of the gun ban, that I read in, on a display on the wall about the cabinet papers being released and the view of the Conservative government at the time. And that's when I realised that I had to write a book. I had to explain how this happened.
Do you think there was light at the end of the tunnel? Do you think it ends on a more positive note?
I would say that what good can we take from the horrors of that day? And I think that the answer to that would be it's incredibly inspirational that the parents themselves were able to set aside briefly their profound grief and help make a next generation of children safer. You know, that they would not face the threat of guns, of school shootings. The reason we don't have school shootings in Britain is because of the parents of Dumbleen and what they achieved. I also feel that Andy Murray is an important figure in the story, a minor figure to a degree initially. His mother knew the gunman. He took part in some of the gunman's boys' clubs. He was in the school on the day of the shooting. He hid under a desk. But then he went on to have this incredible sporting career. So the argument is that the book ends with a chapter, or with a kind of coda, effectively, an epilogue called One Afternoon in July. And it's about the afternoon that he won Wimbledon and how the community gathered in the Dumbleen Centre, which was funded with donations that flooded into the community after the shooting. And the argument is that Columbine will always be Columbine. Hungerford will always be Hungerford. Lockerbie will always be Lockerbie. But Dumbleen, to a new generation, you say the word Dumbleen, you think Andy Murray. And that's an inherently positive thing.
Now, we've heard through the magic of editing, Angus King reading from the book. Were you responsible for his casting?
The answer to that would be no. I was. My feeling in these situations is that the publisher, Swift Press, who've done an excellent job putting the book out, have the best judgment on these situations. And I felt it would be wrong for me to. I think that they always offer you the opportunity to listen to different voices, but I always feel that there's people who have attuned ears to this, and I think he did an excellent job. I certainly couldn't have read it the way that he did.
That's what I was going to ask. You're not fancy doing it yourself?
I couldn't think of something worse, to be honest. on one level, I don't think I'm a particularly good speaker. Some of these people are very, they have wonderful voices. They can use their voices like a musical instrument. And, you know, I'm an out of tune tuba in that respect. And also, I think I would have found it difficult to read the book and not want to change parts of it. As an author, there's a famous phrase, which is you don't finish books, you abandon them. And I think that's true. I mean, even the book is out now and there's things that I would like to have maybe changed or tweaked or added or kept in. You're never fully satisfied, and I think I would have found it difficult. I think I would also find it emotionally difficult to read. And I think you did a very good job with incredibly difficult material.
The officer's first impression was that the camp was a dreary mess. The wooden picnic table was littered with dirty dishes, with only tinned and powdered food available. The chemical toilet appeared well used, but seldom cleaned. The sleeping bags in the three tents were all damp to the touch. A poll of all 13 boys established that only 3 were enthusiastic and actively enjoying themselves, with the remainder complaining that they were homesick and disappointed that they were not permitted to send postcards to their parents or call home during visits back to Luss. Yet when Gunn offered to take anyone home who wished to leave, no child went with them. After talking to the children, Gunn and Duncan wandered around the island until they came to a large sandy beach, where a portly man with a balding head and square glasses was tying up a large wooden rowing boat with an outboard engine, the only transport on and off the island. Unlike the children, he was fully dressed, wearing cotton trousers and a filthy work shirt with sweat stains around the armpits.
One morning in March, Dunblane and the Shooting That Changed Britain by Stephen McGinty is available in audio commercially now, as read by Angus King. And finally, on today's Read On, let's return to Darren McGarvey for The Books of My Life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
No, I mean, I wouldn't even put myself across as someone who fell in love with reading. Music was the literature that was going around in my family. And my family are kind of Celtic background. You've got Irish, you've got Scottish. You know, after a certain amount of drinks in my childhood, certainly, the guitars came out. Mm-hmm. The machetes came later. that was the vibe, you know. You had encyclopedias. There was a big kind of collection of encyclopedias that covered not just topics, but contained poetry and art. And I remember we would open them up and my granny would read to us from them. But it honestly wasn't really until I kind of turned 30 and went and studied journalism and started getting into reading a wee bit more, particularly non-fiction, politics, psychology, and then lately trauma-focused stuff.
Is there a book, rainy day, you would go back to and reread?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a book that really stays with me is Jonathan Haidt has written many books. He's a social psychologist, but he's written, I would say, books that capture the zeitgeist in terms of what the current big civilizational problem is, whether it's talking about mental health, whether it's talking about tribalism and how good people disagree with each other in a very ferocious way, or his recent work, which tackles the rise of smartphones and the correlation between that and poor mental health among young people. I would say that he's someone who really has his finger on the pulse. They're not the cheeriest books to read, but he does manage to split the difference quite well between something that has real academic heft, mm-hmm. but something that's also readable. I would say his best book so far is The Righteous Mind. I think that's been relevant for about 10 years, and that's all about human beings, how they operate as individuals and tribes, moral impulses, and how that plays out politically.
Can We All Get Along? That appeal was made famous on May 1st, 1992, by Rodney King, a black man who had been beaten nearly to death by four Los Angeles police officers a year earlier. The entire nation had seen a videotape of the beating, so when a jury failed to convict the officers, their acquittal triggered widespread outrage and 6 days of rioting in Los Angeles. 53 people were killed, and more than 7,000 buildings were torched. Much of the mayhem was carried live. News cameras tracked the action from helicopters circling overhead. After a particularly horrific act of violence against a white truck driver, King was moved to make his appeal for peace. King's appeal is now so overused that it has become cultural kitsch, a catchphrase more often said for laughs than as a serious plea for mutual understanding. I therefore hesitated to use King's words as the opening line of this book, but I decided to go ahead for two reasons. The first is because most Americans nowadays are asking King's question not about race relations, but about political relations and the collapse of cooperation across party lines. Many Americans feel as though the nightly news from Washington is being sent to us from helicopters circling over the city, delivering dispatches from the war zone. The second reason I decided to open this book with an overused phrase is because King followed it up with something lovely, something rarely quoted. As he stumbled through his television interview, fighting back tears and often repeating himself, he found these words. "Please, we can get along here. We all can get along. I mean, we're all stuck here for a while. Let's try to work it out." This book is about why it's so hard for us to get along. We are indeed all stuck here for a while, so let's at least do what we can to understand why we're so easily divided into hostile groups, each one certain of its righteousness. People who devote their lives to studying something often come to believe that the object of their fascination is the key to understanding everything. Books have been published in recent years on the transformative role in human history played by cooking, mothering, war, even salt. This is one of those books. I study moral psychology, and I'm going to make the case that morality is the extraordinary human capacity that made civilization possible. I don't mean to imply that cooking, mothering, war, and salt were not also necessary, but in this book, I'm going to take you on a tour of human nature and history from the perspective of moral psychology. By the end of the tour, I hope to have given you a new way to think about two of the most important, vexing, and divisive topics in human life, politics and religion. Etiquette books tell us not to discuss these topics in polite company, but I say, go ahead. Politics and religion are both expressions of our underlying moral psychology, and an understanding of that psychology can help to bring people together. My goal in this book is to drain some of the heat, anger, and divisiveness out of these topics and replace them with awe, wonder, and curiosity. We are downright lucky that we evolved this complex moral psychology that allowed our species to burst out of the forests and savannas and into the delights, comforts, and extraordinary peacefulness of modern societies in just a few thousand years. My hope is that this book will make conversations about morality, politics, and religion more common, more civil, and more fun, even in mixed company. My hope is that it will help us to get along.
Jonathan Haidt reading from The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, which is available commercially. Two of his books are in the RNIB library. His new one, The Amazing Generation, and The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. If you're searching, his second name is spelt H-A-I-D-T.
Is there a book you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend?
First fiction that I have read in a long time, and it was McCarthy, and it was The Road. And I picked it because it was short, and I'd been tinkering with the idea of trying to write some fiction, and then I was like, well, I'm going to have to dive into reading some stuff to just get a flavour of things. And I mean, I must have read that in a few days, and actually like reading it wasn't an audiobook. Then I went and watched the film, then I read loads of reviews about it, and I'll probably dive into another one of his actually.
With the first grey light, he rose and left the boy sleeping and walked out to the road and squatted and studied the country to the south. Barren, silent, godless. He thought the month was October, but he wasn't sure. He hadn't kept a calendar for years. They were moving south. There'd be no surviving another winter here. When it was light enough to use the binoculars, he glassed the valley below, everything paling away into the murk, the soft ash blowing and loose swirls over the blacktop. He studied what he could see, the segments of road down there among the dead trees, looking for anything of color, any movement, any trace of standing smoke. He lowered the glasses and pulled down the cotton mask from his face and wiped his nose on the back of his wrist, and then glassed the country again. Then he just sat there holding the binoculars and watching the ashen daylight congeal over the land. He knew only that the child was his warrant. He said, "If he is not the word of God, God never spoke." When he got back, the boy was still asleep. He pulled the blue plastic tarp off of him and folded it and carried it out to the grocery cart and packed it and came back with their plates and some cornmeal cakes and a plastic bag and a plastic bottle of syrup. He spread the small tarp they used for a table on the ground and laid everything out, and he took the pistol from his belt and laid it on the cloth, and then he just sat watching the boy sleep. He'd pulled away his mask in the night, and it was buried somewhere in the blankets. He watched the boy, and he looked out through the trees toward the road. This was not a safe place. They could be seen from the road. Now it was day. The boy turned in the blankets. Then he opened his eyes.
"Hi, Papa,"
he said. "I'm right here."
"I know."
An hour later, they were on the road. He pushed the cart, and both he and the boy carried knapsacks. In the knapsacks were essential things, in case they had to abandon the cart and make a run for it. Clamped to the handle of the cart was a chrome motorcycle mirror that he used to watch the road behind them. He shifted the pack higher on his shoulders and looked out over the wasted country. The road was empty. Below, in the little valley, the still gray serpentine of a river. Motionless and precise. Along the shore, a burden of dead reeds. "Are you okay?" he said. The boy nodded. Then they set out along the blacktop in the gunmetal light, shuffling through the ash, each the other's world and tire.
Pat Courtney reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library in both audio and braille. Thanks once again to everyone at the Boswell Book Festival and everyone at Dumfries House. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long or want to catch up with anything, there are over 480 episodes available online. Just search for RNIB Read On wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can find us at rnib.org.uk.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.